Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the issue of sexual harassment that is now migrating from Roy Moore's past in Alabama back to the occupant in the Oval Office's past, with 56 female members of Congress asking the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform's chairman to investigate charges by at least 17 women who claim they were sexually assaulted or harassed by Donald Trump. Christina Giorgio, an attorney in Manhattan who represents employees in workplace discrimination and sexual harassment disputes, joins us to discuss Trump's response to a call for his resignation from Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who he then smeared, implying that she was willing to trade sex for a campaign contribution from him. Since Christina represents a wide range of clients, we will explore the broader landscape of what women have to deal with in the workplace, in corporate America, government jobs, and small businesses, not to mention waitresses and barmaids, and assess what kind of changes in the law and in our culture are necessary to achieve dignity, safety, and equality in the workplace. Then, with the polls having just closed in Alabama in what is expected to be a close race, we will speak with Mark Denbow, a professor of law at Seton Hall's School of Law, who as a young college student 52 years ago joined the March for Civil Rights in Selma, Alabama, and in 2015 returned to Selma for the commemoration of the 1965 Bloody Sunday. We will discuss how much Roy Moore is a throwback to the days of George Wallace, but given the terror and brutality that Mark and the other marchers endured back then, even Moore's election will not turn back the clock to when African Americans had no rights and were lynched with impunity. Then finally, we will examine the latest annual Arctic Report Card for 2017 with its author, Jeremy Mathis, the director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's NOAA's Arctic Research Program. He joins us to discuss the unprecedented record rate at which the Arctic ice cap is melting, the fastest decline in Arctic sea ice in at least 1,500 years, thus reducing the amount of light reflected back into space, trapping heat, which adds to global warming as the melting ice causes sea levels to rise. And joining us now is Christina Giorgio, who's a managing attorney of Derrick Smith Law Group's Manhattan office, where she focuses on representing employees in workplace discrimination and sexual harassment disputes. She started her legal career as a union-side labor lawyer in Chicago and has sued some of the world's largest corporations over their unjust and unlawful employment practices. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christina Giorgio.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you for joining us, and your senator, the New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who called upon Donald Trump to resign after several women had asked Congress to investigate their stories. All told, there are 19 accusers of Donald Trump. But in response, Donald Trump attacked Kirsten Gillibrand as a total flunky and went on to suggest that she begged him for campaign donations in the past and would do anything for them, a clear smear in the sense that he's more or less implying that she's prostituted, would prostitute herself, or in fact may well have tried to prostitute herself in front of him to get campaign money. In other words, she's willing to trade sex for campaign contributions. That's pretty outrageous, don't you think?
Well, it's very outrageous. I mean, that's absolutely what he was implying. When I heard that, I thought, oh my gosh, here goes Donald Trump yet again, you know, attacking people when they're raising very, very serious matters and doing it in the most outrageous fashion possible.
And, of course, the 56 members of the Democratic Women's Working Group in Congress have asked the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform, chaired by Trey Gowdy, to look into the issue of all of these women making complaints against Donald Trump. Of course, Trey Gowdy being famous for the Benghazi inquiry. I'm not holding my breath. How about you?
Oh, no. I don't think we would have long on this earth if we were holding our breath for that, Ian.
So let's turn to the work that you do, because my understanding is you take cases across a broad spectrum of working life in America for women, in not just in big corporations, but in government, state, local, federal, and small business. I imagine the area where sexual harassment is most endemic probably is, would it be with waitresses and barmaids, et cetera? I mean, where is the worst offenders?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, sadly, we can't say that this is relegated to any portion of the workforce in the United States. I have clients who are executives at elite banks. I have clients who are, you know, have PhDs working in academics. And I have women who, you know, are taking tickets at movie theaters. It's really across the board, and it's so ingrained and entrenched in our culture with respect to how many women, but how many men, of course, most men are appropriate at work, and I don't want to sound like, you know, there's not a man out there with, you know, without a clue with respect to how to treat women and their colleagues at work. But unfortunately, there is a very substantial percentage of the male workforce who does see a women showing up to work as sort of a dating system. I routinely have to prosecute cases where my clients are simply just showing up to work, and their coworkers and typically their supervisors are expecting them to date them. And if they don't, their job is in jeopardy. And, you know, it's, you know, very, very challenging for women, because there's very few people who go to work just for the fun of it. You know, we, you know, myself, I love my work, but most of us are doing it because we need to. We need to put food on the table. We need to support our families, our parents, our children, things like this. And to make dating your boss or a coworker who may be sponsored by a boss in some way, making dating this person a prerequisite to keeping your job, of course, puts you know, entire communities really in peril.
But surely the fact that your clients come to you, my sense would be that women who actually hire a lawyer to get justice would be in a minority of those that are harassed.
Well, I suppose that's true. I mean, I don't have statistics on that, but I do know that the Me Too campaign is very good evidence that this is just all too common. I certainly experienced a certain amount of sexual harassment early in my legal career, and at that time, in the early 90s, when I was in law school and finishing law school, certainly this was a time where, you know, the press was focused on Anita Hill and what was happening there. But at the time, it really did not seem reporting was even an option from a career perspective. And I hate to say it, it really hasn't changed that much. It is easier. The internet has been very helpful, a great equalizer in terms of access to legal representation. You know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, just trying to find a lawyer was much harder. You know, now there are a lot of resources out there. Women can do, you know, comparative shopping and whatnot. But in terms of the professional cost and price that women pay for reporting these things is all too high. It is a rare case where the woman is supported in the way that she really needs to be. And part of that is it's incumbent upon companies to investigate these things in an unbiased way. But oftentimes the unbiased approach ends up victimizing and penalizing the woman who came forward. That's something that we see repeatedly. And it's not uncommon for women to just simply try to work within this environment in order to keep her job.
And again, I'm speaking with Christina Giorgio, who's a managing attorney of Derek Smith Law Group's Manhattan office, where she focuses on representing employees in workplace discrimination and sexual harassment disputes. She started her legal career as a union-side labor lawyer in Chicago and has sued some of the world's largest corporations over their unjust and unlawful employment practices. So are the statutes on the books then adequate? Is this a legal problem, a cultural problem, or a combination of both?
Well, it's certainly a cultural problem. We have several, you know, we have the federal statutes, and that is available to all workers across the country. And then you have states and adopting their own anti-discrimination laws, which, of course, capture sexual harassment. And then typically you have cities adopting their own. And it's not uncommon for these statutes to mirror the federal statute, but sometimes a city or a state will go farther. And some of these laws are very, very good. But the problem is that the culture is so entrenched in terms of viewing women as, of course, not every man and not every office, but there is a pervasive cultural bias towards seeing women as, sexual objects, open for dating. That's why they're there, at least in part. So we really need to see a cultural shift, and there are so many good male voices out there. With regard to Senator Franken, I think that this is a very important case for us to discuss. It's a very difficult case, and I know I was listening to your show maybe last week talking about sort of the political calculus around why the pressure, the additional pressure for him to step down, and what's happening with Roy Moore in Alabama. But this is a case where you're asking, what type of tolerance will we have when it comes down to demeaning women at work? And you have somebody like Mr. Franken, who is really a recognized voice for women. He's been an excellent senator with respect to women's rights. And yet you have him on record, at least in some instances. I certainly was not there. I can't say whether, the accusations are in fact true. But there is at least these photographs where he is engaged in behavior that, again, demeans women. And so to me, personally and professionally, when you have somebody as enlightened and as gentlemanly as Al Franken, also engaged in this type of, demeaning conduct towards women, it really shows you how pervasive the problem is, because you have, unfortunately, a lot of people who have been raised, to be less informed with respect to issues of oppression and power dynamics. So we have a real cultural problem, but I think that what's happening now and the discussion and the public attention, we will see a shift, but at the same time, I try to remind people that this was a hotly debated discussion in the early 90s with respect to Anita Hill and the Supreme Court confirmation. And it was recognized at that time that sexual harassment was a very, very deep-seated and common problem in the workplace. You have a lot of important Supreme Court decisions coming out with respect to how we define sexual harassment. For a long time, it's been recognized as a deep problem in our workforce. It hasn't changed. It's not going away. I mean, I think that from a legal perspective and what we're going to see happen with our caseload is that, of course, we're going to see, I'm sure, a level of uptake with more women coming forward. They're being educated as to what is actionable, what is not actionable. But my hope is that employers will take this as an educational opportunity to really make the changes that they need to make within their corporate offices to ensure that there's just zero tolerance for a hostile work environment with respect to any type of unlawful discrimination, but particularly with respect to sexual harassment, because the power dynamic between men and women is very unequal. Women still have a long way to go before they are on par with men with respect to their positions of power. And until we get there, corporations and employers need to do more to make sure that these policies that they may have in place, it's not lip service, that there's really meaningful training and meaningful opportunity to report things and to report it in a safe way so that people don't feel that they're going to lose their jobs.
But in terms of the law and statute, is it a case, though, that the sort of corporatization of the law in a way, for example, with class actions becoming less and less available to citizens and more people in the corporate world are being forced into arbitration. Does that also apply to HR, human resources in corporate America, where I understand the expectation is that if you're being harassed and you're a woman in the workplace in corporate America, then you can go to HR. And if you don't go to HR, then that's kind of held against you, even if you think it's worthless going to them in the first place.
Well, sure. Well, you mentioned arbitration, and this is a growing, what can I say, it's certainly a trend, and it's very problematic from an employment standpoint because, you know, people are accepting jobs, and from day one, they're signing away their federal rights, their state rights, to be in court to resolve any disputes they have with their employer as it relates to discrimination. It's a very unfortunate trend. But with respect to how the law, in some ways, I don't want to say insulates employers, but it certainly allows employers an opportunity to defend themselves, even if there's a very hostile work environment, which they have not done enough to address. There is something called a Fair-Ellerth defense, and when a corporation has taken upon themselves to institute sexual harassment policies so that they make it clear that, you know, they don't tolerate it and that every employer has an opportunity to report these things, when they have that program in place and an employee fails to take advantage of it in certain instances, and I'm sort of oversimplifying it, but in certain instances, that is a way for employers to say, no, you know, there's not liability here because this particular individual didn't take advantage of these programs. So there is, you know, clearly a corporate bias developing in the American jurisprudence for quite some time. I think with respect to sexual harassment, the laws are actually, they're quite good, and we have some very good case law. You know, sexual harassment, when lawmakers and judges are faced with it, you know, they get it. They get that this is just fundamentally unfair. But the problem is that, one of the problems is that you have so much of it occurring in private, where bosses typically wait to be alone with their subordinate. And so it is very common. We see it over and over again that harassers, men, sometimes women, but men who do engage in this type of unlawful conduct at work, they're crafty, they're smart about it, and they wait till they're alone with the person who they've decided to pressure for, you know, sexual favors or just to be inappropriate around. So it can become very difficult for the person who's been victimized in this way to actually support her case because it becomes a he said, she said situation. And, you know, when you're prosecuting a case, the person bringing the charges has the burden. You know, I always tell my clients, you know, when we're going forward, our case must be better than the defendant's case, right? And so when you have this he said, she said, it can become very difficult. And over and over and over again, I see these supervisors waiting till the person's alone, and then it becomes very difficult. You know, I know we don't have a lot of time. I do want to mention one thing with respect to the confidentiality agreements. I know that there's been a lot of discussion around the problems with confidentiality agreements, and we see them all the time. Prosecuting these cases, very difficult. I mean, they're very embarrassing. They're very demoralizing to have to talk about graphic things. And people understandably want to settle before it becomes a public matter. Or even after they've filed their suit, they want to be spared the trauma of having to be deposed with respect to these very, very sensitive matters. And the confidentiality agreement is something we see all the time. And I think that we're going to see more and more pushback on these confidentiality agreements. And I think that's going to be a real breakthrough because up until recently, there's a real culture of silence and gagging, like gag orders, around discussing who is doing the harassing. And with regard to the tax bill, there are some changes proposed there relating to the deductibility of your attorney's expenses when it comes down to defending sexual harassment claims. One of the things in the tax bill, basically, it says, if there's a confidentiality agreement in place with respect to settling a sexual harassment claim, you will not be able to deduct the settlement amount as a business expense. That's a very, I mean, I'm not sure if that's going to survive, but I think that that's going to be a very good thing. I'm not a supporter at all of this bill, but that did catch my attention, that could be, we could see some significant changes because corporations are very motivated to have everything hush up, hushed up, not discussed, and so we won't be embarrassed. But, you know, these corporations are very much motivated by their bottom line. And up until now, it just hasn't been hitting their bottom line hard enough for them to make the hard decisions to make cultural changes within their offices.
Well, just in closing then, where is the battlefield? I mean, the day after Donald Trump's inauguration, there was a spontaneous gathering of millions of women around the country and around the world, for that matter. And it was spontaneous, and one got the definite impression that women are becoming more of a political force, and we'll see what happens in Alabama tonight. But in general, there's a sense of women asserting themselves politically. But we also, early in the conversation, you know, mentioned that this is as much a cultural problem as a political problem. Does that mean that women have to fight on two fronts, or how do you see this battle going forward?
Well, like I said, I do see this as an opportunity for employers to get real with being serious in making sure that this type of hostile work environment or quid pro quo, which is basically a type of sexual harassment where your boss is requiring sexual favors to keep, you know, in order to allow you to keep your job. I think that this is a teachable moment for corporate America, in part because they're realizing how expensive this could be for them. But in terms of where the battleground is, it's very intoxicating to watch women support each other as they have been supporting each other over the last several months, very publicly. Again, these are very difficult things to talk about, but the sheer numbers, you know, you can no longer pretend that this is just a one-off event. There's a real demand for cultural change, and women, I think, are now given the platform to discuss these things, knowing that it's safe to come forward. I have many clients, you know, who of course came forward before the spotlight, and they came forward when it wasn't safe. And it's not like it's still entirely safe for women, but women are more likely to be believed now, and that is a very significant cultural shift. But at the same time, we can't let this moment pass. We have to keep pushing forward and trying to, of course, change laws where there are weaknesses. I mean, certainly on the Hill, the opportunities for sexual harassment and non-accountability is an outlier. I mean, you have these people in Congress who really get to end run the sexual harassment laws that other employers have to face. And I think that there needs to be changes in Washington, and of course, with respect to the president, where he can brag about groping the private parts of women and seeing that as one of his fine attributes. This needs to be deemed as utterly unacceptable, and I don't think that the pressure on Donald Trump should retreat. I think that these women are absolutely right to push forward on that, because it's the president who largely sets the tone for what's acceptable culturally, and the tone he's set is so unacceptable that it is very grateful to these women for coming forward.
Well, Christina Georgiou, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Christina Georgiou, who's the managing attorney of Derrick Smith Law Group's Manhattan office, where she focuses on representing employees in workplace discrimination and sexual harassment disputes. She started her legal career as a union-side labor lawyer in Chicago and has sued some of the world's largest corporations over their unjust and unlawful employment practices.